from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, more than 10% of school-aged children in the United States, that's 6.4 million kids, have been medically diagnosed with ADHD. That's more than a 40% increase from a decade ago. UC Berkeley professors Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler wonder whether diagnosis can be traced to our country's push for academic achievement and school accountability. At the same time, they say kids from families with little access or trust in the healthcare system are often underdiagnosed with ADHD and missing out on helpful treatment. We'll talk with them about their new book. It's called The ADHD Explosion, and that's coming up right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. More than 10% of school-aged children in the United States, that's 6.4 million kids, have been medically diagnosed with ADHD. That's more than a 40% increase from a decade ago. UC Berkeley professors Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler wonder whether diagnosis can be traced to our country's push for academic achievement and school accountability. And they're with us to talk about this. Stephen Hinshaw, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, vice chair psychology at UCSF, also co-author of the book. And the book is called The ADHD Explosion, subtitled Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Richard Scheffler, who joins us by phone, co-author of this book, who's professor of health economics and public policy at UC Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you both here. And let me begin, Stephen Hinshaw, with you. First of all, we get into this whole problem of how do we diagnose ADHD, and is it biological? Is it social? I mean, does it come from pressures like you seem to be arguing here, or is it maybe unfathomable in many ways? But the numbers are staggering, and the numbers are what we really have to deal with here.
The numbers are going up astronomically, but the clear answer to your question is ADHD is entirely 100% biological and 100% social and cultural at the same time. We've got to think organically about this. We all have certain genes switch on in our brains, and some of us are really focused. Some of us are really scattered, distracted by almost anything, and most of us in the middle. That didn't matter all that much for human survival as hunter-gatherers or on the farms, but what did we start doing 150, 200 years ago? Compulsory education. We made kids go to school, learn to read that human brains never evolved to do. So all of a sudden, those genetically mediated differences in focus, attention, impulse control now stand out like a sore thumb if you're not so good at it. So the biology is real, but compulsory education in many ways revealed ADHD, and the continuing push for performance today is making it stand out and get diagnosed even more than it used to be.
But this is also a global phenomenon. So you're not only talking about, and you have the data that shows that states that really stress test to a greater degree have more of an ADHD problem, but you're also talking about the workplace, and you're talking about the economy and all of those stresses as well, which seem to also exacerbate, yes?
Yes, that's right. It's clear that ADHD is diagnosed more in the U.S. than anywhere else we know, but it's diagnosed at a rate of around 5 to 6% of school-age kids in all industrialized countries. The only nations that really don't, quote, have ADHD are subsistence countries. Once countries come online with a certain amount of economic development and compulsory education is the law of the land, a surprisingly similar percentage of kids have these fundamental troubles in focusing and paying attention. But the big question for us is, amidst this global backdrop, why are the rates going up so startlingly in the U.S., and why is there such variation even within our boundaries?
And Richard Scheffler, looking at the figures that come from your book, it's heaviest in the South and the Midwest, lowest actually here in the West, but over two-thirds of the people who are diagnosed receive medication, and some of these diagnoses will come with, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has pretty much countenanced these early diagnoses, like around the age of four, but they're given sometimes 10, 15 minutes at a doctor's office and got a diagnosis.
Yes, this is very troubling. You're quite right. The rates are higher
in the south and lower on the west coast and lower in California. This has been historic for a long time. And when Steve and I tried to figure out why the rates were spiking, we looked at a map, and you see this huge variation across the United States in the rates. And we really couldn't find a good contender in the healthcare system. Steve mentioned genetics, healthcare policy, healthcare coverage, but all of a sudden school policy jumped out at us. And so we tracked it down and found out generally in the 1990s, about 30-some-odd states started to tie their budgets of the schools and the performance of the teachers and their salaries and even the principals to how well the kids tested and graduation rates. And those states had much higher rates of increase of ADHD diagnosis than the states that didn't. And, of course, President Bush came along with No Child Left Behind and made this national policy, and then the rest of the states had increases in rates as well. So there's definitely something in the push for academic performance in the United States. You mentioned globally. There's no doubt that this is a global phenomenon now. We track sales of global medications now. They're going up 20-plus percent per year. This Ritalin, Concerta, Adderall, these medications are the number one medication globally sold to children for in the mental health field. So clearly something important is going on, not only in the United States, but the rest of the world.
And all medications that do have side effects. In fact, Adderall has been pretty much characterized as possibly a gateway drug. Kids who are addicted to it wind up often using other drugs. And I'm wondering, what's the toll of all this? I mean, you know, you're the health economist. There's a tremendous toll on society.
Yeah, there is side effects of taking any drug, and there's clearly side effects of these or not. The science base, whether it's Adderall or some other drug, I think there's evidence on both sides of that. But the issue is not treating these kids and putting them on, not putting them on medication if they need it has enormous cost to them. School dropout rates are amazingly high for kids who aren't treated. Accident rates, particularly automobiles, and social isolation, and working in the environment, and unemployment rates, divorce rates for people who are, you know, in the middle age. We have to balance the risk of any drug against the potential benefits.
Well, Stephen Henshaw, let me get back with you to the diagnosis or the diagnostic challenges in this. I mean, we talk often about impulsivity and focus and self-regulation, time managing, all these kinds of things. But a lot of that's subjective, and a lot of that comes down to almost making, as I said, a quick diagnosis in a doctor's office that can be just in a matter of minutes. I always remember the episode of The Sopranos where Tony and his wife were told that their kid had ADHD, and he said, "What are the symptoms?" And they said, "Fidgeting," you know, and he said, "Fidgeting," you know, and that great James Gandolfini way of delivering a line. Some of these really are kind of subjective and come about as a result of pretty quick reads that don't necessarily hold up. There's overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis,
that's
I recognize.
Right.
Yeah.
The American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry have both in the last few years published extensive guidelines for how to evaluate, assess, and diagnose this condition. You can't do it in 10 or 15 minutes accurately. You'll over and underselect, as you just mentioned. It's going to take observations in schools. It's going to take objective reports from parents and teachers. It's going to take a good developmental history. Maybe there was early trauma. Maybe there's a subtle seizure disorder. If you do it right, we still don't have a blood test or brain scan that definitively diagnoses ADHD or any mental illness. But we can do a much better job than the cursory evaluations. And when we do, as Richard just pointed out, if we can offer treatment, not just medication, but the skills-based behavioral treatments in homes and schools to really enhance competencies, those are the combination treatments that give these kids a fighting chance of developing in ways that way too many kids with ADHD without adequate treatment really end up in trouble. But it all comes back to, are we going to train doctors? Are we going to enforce standards? And are we going to reimburse the medical profession for doing this? Upholding the diagnostic standards that they should be held to.
Better medication and, I mean, better coordination between skill building and medication, essentially.
Absolutely.
Is what you're saying. So how does this translate, Richard Scheffler, into public policy? Or how would it translate? Assuming you have the diagnostic tools, yeah.
Right. Well, I think in public policy, first we, being a health economist, we go to reimbursement, and the medications are generally reimbursed now on most healthcare plans and even Medi-Cal and Medicaid in most states. The medication rate globally, if you're diagnosed in the United States, is 70%. There are state variations. But the reimbursement for the skill-based work that Dr. Henshaw talked about treating them clinically and understanding and talking to them and working with the parents, that's not reimbursed very well in our healthcare system. And so this is a huge gap, and we need to think about the total effective treatment for these children. This is quite serious. These are powerful drugs, and if we have the right diagnosis, I think we know what the right treatment is. But unfortunately, like a lot of things, it's going to cost money up front. But we save a lot of money downstream because that kid stays in school, that kid graduates, that kid has friends, that kid has a better chance at life, and that's what this is about.
Well, we're talking a lot about kids, but a quarter of college students are using stimulants now for academic performance, according to your book, and the numbers are rising in the adult population. Let's talk a little bit, if we could, with you, Professor Scheffler, just about the job sectors. I mean, a lot of ADHD, I presume, would be dangerous in many job situations, not only for the person who's doing the work, but for others. And if they can't focus and the like, you've got stories of people, for example, who have jobs that involve a great deal of pressure and where lives are at stake. And often they'll have to commute many miles, they'll drive, and they'll have ADHD, and they won't necessarily have full focus abilities.
Well, I think that's right. There are, of course, lots of different jobs that require, physical performance, but there are many more now that require mental performance. And as we know, sitting in front of a computer and focusing and having those skills, and so this is new in the job world, and a lot of people do not have the training and the ability to do this. So we see the rates now of diagnosis and treatment of adults going up astronomically. This is the new market for ADHD and the drugs, and so this is competition for your jobs. We know how difficult it is to get a good-paying job, not just a job, but a good-paying job. It's skill-based, it requires mental acuity, and the competition is not only for people in the United States, but you're competing for jobs globally. I mean, in Silicon Valley, they don't care if you went to Berkeley or Stanford. If you're really good and you're from China or India, you're going to get that job.
Hey, if you know how to code, I don't think you need a college degree these days.
Exactly.
Sorry to say.
So the issue is there's a lot of pressure for those kind of skills. And the college kids, this is a total disaster. I mean, Steve and I found the horrible rates of increase of visits to emergency rooms of hospitals because of kids taking these drugs. They're not smart pills. They will keep you up. They will allow you to focus. But if you buy them, and when you buy them from someone else, this is illegal. This is a felony. Kids need to understand that. But if you buy them and you buy the wrong dose and you take it and it's not appropriate for you, you can end up in an emergency room in a hospital, and this is quite serious. We are very alarmed about that.
Should mention that ADHD, which is somewhat of a stigma to be sure, affects boys more than it does girls, at least in numbers, and with girls there's a higher propensity for self-injury and suicide, especially among girls and young women. And Stephen Henshaw, how much of this is really due, do you think, to... You single out the economy, the pressures for job, you single out, test scores and the pressures in school, but what about... Well, number one, I would say technology and new technology.
Right. Well, let's focus on girls and women for a minute. We started back in the 90s in Berkeley a study we now call the B-GALS study, the Berkeley Girls with ADHD Longitudinal Study. It's the largest sample of girls with ADHD that we know of in the world, starting in childhood, proceeding into adolescence, now into young adulthood. And very alarming is that like boys, girls with ADHD have academic and social and vocational problems as they get older. But unlike boys and young men, girls with ADHD, especially those with early impulsivity, are at enormously high risk, not just for thinking about suicide, but making serious attempts, and for the forms of cutting and mutilation that we call non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. So girls have the pressures of being adolescents, which is harder than for boys. Girls who are impulsive and do the wrong thing at the wrong time are really disliked by other girls as well as boys. They get into social hot water, and they tend to internalize and take it out against themselves. This is a public health threat that we don't find in boys with ADHD. It means that we've got to take the diagnosis of ADHD in girls very seriously. Now, you also mentioned high tech. Maybe we're all less attentive. Forget 500 channels, it's now 5,000, or is it 5 million? And social media, and everybody's on a device. And that may make everybody's attention in our country and much of the Western world less attentive than before, but it's the backdrop against which those genetically mediated differences that some people are inherently less focused than others, now those people are at even bigger risk. Now, on the one hand, lots of people with ADHD do seemingly well at video games, and they're high-tech people, but it's sort of a mistake. People with ADHD look like they're performing well on video games, but they're actually not performing as skillfully as those without ADHD. So high-tech culture is both a good thing for productivity in society, and we've all got to learn these skills, but for ADHD, it's a mixed blessing.
But where, for example, do other, you mentioned a number of these in your book, there are other dimensions to this problem. I mean, there's the media. The media continues to feed on this, and you got cover stories in Time and Newsweek and all the major magazines. And there's also Big Pharma, which plays a role, a big role.
So back 20 years ago, drug manufacturers could really only advertise to physicians. Things changed 15 years ago in the U.S. We're now the only country other than New Zealand that allows DTC, direct-to-consumer advertisements, on TV, in women's magazines, in mainstream magazines. There's ads about bipolar disorder and depression and ADHD and medications you might take. Now, on the one hand, you can say, this is countering stigma. I can publicly talk about it. It's in the newspaper, it's in the magazine, it's on TV. I guess it's okay for me to come out of the closet. Or, on the other hand, is this disease mongering? Is it creating a market for only the medication treatments really get advertised? And are we creating a false market for everybody to find the right doctor to get diagnosed?
And maybe both.
And I think both are going on at the same time. Right?
And what about, we were talking to the authors of the ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance, Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler, both professors at UC Berkeley, Stephen Hinshaw, professor of psychology, and Richard Scheffler, professor of health economics and public policy. What are the myths we're talking about here, Richard Scheffler?
Well, I think the big myth is what you started with. Is this a real disease? Does it really exist? And I think Steve answered that extremely well. It has a biological root. It's environmentally triggered and in fact, does exist. The myths also perhaps being pushed by pharmaceutical companies and their ads. We look at the ads in the book and analyze them. Is that, these medications are a magic bullet. They're actually going to change your child's life, and that's just not the case. They can be helpful when appropriate, but they're not a smart pill, and there's still a lot of work that has to be done by the parents and the schools to help this child along. So I think the myth that these medications solve this, I think, is one that we want to debunk, and we look at it in the book. And also, these advertisements provide information, no doubt, but unfortunately, pharmaceutical companies aren't always forthright in the information that they put in these ads and also the images that they have in the advertisements that they have. And from constantly, the FDA is monitoring this and finding false information in the ads. And also slapping fines and other sanctions on pharmaceutical companies. So we need to be careful about this information. We want more information for parents to do a better job, because they're the ones that have to decide. Well, we want to make sure that this information is good information and doesn't create the myth that your child needs this medication when they really don't.
So the caveat to parents particularly would be to monitor this as closely and as carefully as they can, get all the facts and...
I mean, it's a life decision. I mean, it generally happens, as Steve and I point out, when your child enters school, so the child is, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, very tender age, and a diagnosis of ADHD is a life event. It changes their self-image. It changes how the school deals with them and how the parents deal with them. So it is very important for the parent to make a well-informed decision, talking to the teachers, but also getting a good clinical evaluation, because when your child is put on this drug, it changes them, and it's a very powerful drug. So we need to get it right early on.
Well, it's quite vexing, because the earlier you can get it, the better you can have results, but there's so much in the way of misdiagnosis. And I saw the article you two did for the New York Times putting out this caveat, broadside caveat, really, on the epidemic of 4- and 5-year-olds wrongfully being told that they have ADHD, which really ought to put a lot of concern and alarm into parents. I'm just wondering, though, about underdiagnosis, Stephen Henshaw, because you write about that as well.
It's still stigmatizing, as you pointed out a few moments ago, to get a diagnostic label. You've got a mental disorder. You've got a developmental delay. You've got a condition called ADHD. It must be that bad parenting. It must be the weak moral character of the kid. And on the one hand, we don't want to falsely label and brand kids and give them medication when it's not needed. On the other hand, to deny the reality of this condition, which is extremely impairing, we have to make sure that the diagnosis is made accurately. And when it is, it can actually be empowering. It doesn't mean that medication is the only answer. It can be an important component. But it means that the family may not be as blamed as they were, but they still have responsibility for getting homework monitored, working with the teacher, enforcing better limits at home. It's these combination treatments of skill building and, when needed, medication that really give these kids a fighting chance of developing the competencies that so many kids need even more than ever in this competitive era we live in.
Let's talk just for a moment, if we could, about the medications, because we mentioned Adderall, we mentioned Ritalin, but in some instances we're talking about SSRIs, aren't we?
So SSRIs are used usually in ancillary fashion for a kid or adolescent or teen with ADHD who's got anxiety and depression. SSRIs work on serotonin, as their name implies, not on the dopamine and norepinephrine systems, and they really don't have much benefit for ADHD at all. It's the stimulants that do. So we call SSRIs SSRIs. I think we should call stimulants SDRIs, selective dopamine reuptake inhibitors, because they promote dopamine flow in the brain the way that SSRIs promote serotonin flow, and that can help your focus and concentration. It doesn't mean that if you don't have ADHD, it teaches you lots of skills. You've got to combine them with educational intervention.
We're talking again about the dramatic rise in ADHD diagnosis in school children, dramatic rise really across the board, with the co-authors of a book called The ADHD Explosion: Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Stephen Henshaw and Richard Scheffler with us, and you can be with us as well. We invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Questions or comments, welcome. Again, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to the co-authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Richard Scheffler with us by phone is professor of health economics and public policy at UC Berkeley. Stephen Henshaw is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and also vice chair for psychology at UCSF. And I should mention that the CDC put out some figures on this. 1 in 9, that's 6.4 million youth. So we are talking about an explosion. The numbers just keep going up, and it's disconcerting, to put it mildly, when we actually look at these numbers and examine them as they continue to escalate. Explosion is the right word. And it's also an explosion in terms of prescribed medication, overprescription. 70% of those youth who have ADHD or who are diagnosed as having ADHD are given prescriptions of one sort or another, and there are, you know, untold effects on children, certainly, with prescriptions, side effects and the like, although in some cases they certainly help and help immensely. It's, as I said earlier, a vexing problem. Let me go to your calls, and let's begin with Gwendolyn from San Francisco. You're on.
Hi. I've been generally a classroom, and now I'm a special ed classroom. And some of the behavior with this ADHD, it's cultural, and it's also it's a gender. Boys can be hyperactive, and one reason I went into special ed is because I have an extra person. I have an aide, sometimes two aides, and I think rather than over prescribing drugs, maybe just have a one-on-one for your student if you don't want him pulled out of, put in a special ed, you know, to make sure that he's looking at the teacher, he has his pencils and everything he needs, and that he stays on topic, too. Also, I've worked in private schools where kids can get up and wander and do what they want. So I think what you mentioned, the No Child Left Behind and the stress that the teacher, principal, and kid that's under, I think that's probably why we're seeing a higher rate in this.
Well, thank you for your comments, Gwendolyn. Much obliged. I'm wondering, Richard Scheffler, just about, I think, I remember talking to an old friend of mine, Dean Adell, whom listeners know from his days as a TV and radio doc, about the fact that we probably both would have been diagnosed as ADHD when we were kids because we were overly rambunctious and somewhat aggressive and assertive.
Well, I don't know about that. There's a long list of symptoms, and that's only a piece of the puzzle. But
if you're getting these quick diagnoses, I think you're getting them based on
some of those kind of
observations.
Yeah, sure. As Steve pointed out, you can't do this in 10 minutes. But I think if you have a full evaluation, you might have and might not. And, of course, the diagnosis of ADHD has, you know, really three separate groups, so to speak, those who are really seriously impaired, and those that are moderate and those that are mild. And you might have snuck into the mild category, who knows, but being aggressive is not the criteria for becoming ADHD. But there is a cultural bias, as your call-in person mentioned, and that's one of the reasons why California still has a lower rate than other states, and it's partly because Hispanics are less likely to seek a diagnosis, and their culture allows more freedom for boys to act out, and perhaps girls as well, and so and also reluctance generally for Hispanics to be treated for mental health problems. And the same is true, but for different reasons, for Asians as well. So the stigma is down, however. We found in our book, we looked 10, 15 years ago, there was a significant difference between the rate of diagnosis and treatment of blacks and whites, and now those rates are essentially the same. And part of that happened because stigma went down, and part of it also happened because a lot of these black children were covered by the expanding health insurance program for children in the United States, which allowed some parents to get treatment that and have it paid for by the state or the insurance company. But there's clearly a strong cultural biases in the diagnosis and the treatment of ADHD.
Well, that cultural bias, I was struck by Gwendolyn's comments, certainly plays a role in how teachers decide and move along the process of who has ADHD or who ought to be looked at for ADHD. What's your advice specifically to teachers, particularly given...
Well, I think teachers are an important component of it, but let's be absolutely clear. Teachers do not do the diagnosis. They're not trained. They don't have the background. It's not appropriate for them to do that. They can raise concerns in the school and perhaps talk to the parent about that. But the diagnosis has to be done by a qualified health professional.
I'm with you on that, but I think teachers play a pretty integral role here, don't they?
No, absolutely. They play a key role, but they do not do the diagnosis. And certainly they notice things. And we need to be really careful because certain students are acting out and not performing well in the class because the teacher isn't very good. Or the teacher is over-restrictive. So that's only one sign. The child would have to show those symptoms in different environments, in the home, in their play group and the like. So we know it's not environmentally triggered, but teachers are absolutely key. There's no doubt. That's where the diagnosis generally happens when the child enters school. So they need to be better informed. I hope they will take a look at our book and understand how the world is perceiving ADHD, the pressures on the parents, society, what's going on, to get a fuller understanding, because they are absolutely key in what happens to the child and their treatment for ADHD, but they are not the ones doing the treatment or making the diagnosis.
And Richard Scheffler, professor of health economics and public policy at UC Berkeley and co-author with Stephen Hinshaw of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Let me bring another caller in. Jeff, that's you. Welcome to Forum.
Yeah, I would say that the stigma is still very strong, and that gets in the way of access to treatment. I knew something was an issue with my daughter from birth, but it took us until 7 to get access to treatment. Our pediatrician was, getting in the way of things and slowing it down, and finally we got in at Stanford. But there's our society, we would never tell a kid with diabetes, suck it up and make your own insulin. But we tell kids who have, autism or disorders or ADHD disorders, oh, you can't medicate, you're a bad parent.
Stephen Hinshaw.
Well, I really resonate with the caller to an extreme. When medications are given for kids with ADHD, there's some tantalizing evidence that they might actually be neuroprotective. Kids with ADHD over time actually have slight brain shrinkage over the years. Giving the right dose of medication to kids who really need it might actually help the brain hold its own and stay more intact. So one of the myths in the book is that medications are poisons and you've got to be a terrible parent and why would you ever do that to your kid? We still have a different attitude about diabetes than we do about ADHD. The caller's absolutely right. Now, at the same time, over-diagnosing and over-medicating or assuming that these pills are performance enhancers for everybody is going in the opposite direction. We know that so many, not only college, but high school students without ADHD taking these medications, assuming that it's helping their learning. Well, as Richard pointed out before the break, yes, you pay better attention and can stay up later, but there's very little evidence that unless you really have serious ADHD symptoms, these pills are helping you learn, but it really puts you at risk for substance abuse.
You do have a chapter here, though, chapter 4, about neuroenhancement, and you talk about the value in promoting academic success. If you have kids who are really limited and have barriers because of this condition, then the medication can really help break through.
If you have ADHD and you have learning problems, medication won't teach you a skill, but it prepares your brain to learn much better. And in a publication for which Richard was first author some years ago, we found that in a nationally representative sample of kindergartners, when those kids with ADHD got on medication, not only did they fidget less, but their test scores went up. Now, the test scores didn't persist up for the rest of their development. It's going to take educational and behavioral interventions in addition to medication. So, medication, when it's indicated, may be neuroprotective and it may promote achievement. But the thought that everybody out there, especially high-pressured high school and college students who need to get better grades, that these are magically smart pills, that's a mistaken assumption.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your web comments and emails. Mark writes, the comment that people with ADHD cannot focus is not accurate. Many people with ADHD can focus well and hyperfocus when they're engaged in an activity that they're interested in. This is well documented.
ADHD is a disorder of self-regulation, not just attention. Are you able to shift gears when the situation calls for it? Can you devote that effortful attention when the teacher's at her most boring? Can you lift out of task A into task B? So it's attention maintenance, it's set shifting, it's making a plan. These are the executive functions that ADHD really is involved with. It's not just, quote, not being able to pay attention. It's how to shift and regulate attention. So the email's quite accurate.
And another web comment, getting back to the cultural differences we were discussing with you, Richard Scheffler. This is a listener who says, my six-year-old daughter's public school here in the South Bay, where she is in a minority. She's been singled out a few times for her handwriting and typical six-year-old excitable and chatty behavior. Her teachers have suggested I have her evaluated for occupational therapy and see a psychologist. I have done both, and these providers have verified my daughter does not have ADHD or a fine motor delay. These providers have suggested it is the culture of our public school that has created this illusion, and that just because your temperament and culture are different, there's often an assumption that you have a learning difference or mental health diagnosis. I find this incredibly disturbing.
Well, it is disturbing, and I'm glad that that this woman had her child, took the warning and concern seriously, and had the child appropriately examined and found out that there was a negative diagnosis. This is what Steve and I are hoping happens. There are pressures on schools, there's no doubt, in California as well, and local schools for the students to do better. And I'm sure the motives of the school were, in this case, pure, trying to help the child and help her do better. So this is a case where I think it was basically win-win. I don't think there was, I don't know the circumstances, whether the fact that she was a minority mattered in this particular case. But nevertheless, all parents should take these warnings seriously and do exactly what this person did.
Let me read a few more web comments. Lisa writes, diagnosis of this condition is out of control in our college-age kids as well. My son, influenced by his friends to a great extent, was convinced he had ADHD. I, on the other hand, thought he was just a typical college freshman who had a 4.0 GPA, by the way. We finally gave in and let him see a doctor in the area where he is in college, and about $2,500 later, in 15 minutes in the doctor's office, he walked away with a prescription. The doctor told him if he wanted to, he could just take the medication prior to exams and it would help. In the end, he took the pills for about 2 weeks and decided on his own that it was pointless. I think many of these doctors, and this one came highly recommended, are little more than pill mills. Another listener writes, my brother was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, yet he made it through school fine without drugs and is a successful PhD scientist. I think his ADHD has contributed to his success and creativity. ADHD must have some positive impact in society. Shouldn't we just accept and teach to the strengths rather than medicating? Stephen Hitchcock?
Well, this is an intriguing point. Maybe ADHD is really a bankload of hidden gifts and talents. And there's certainly something to that. When it's severe, people with ADHD will tell you that they're so impulsive and so dysregulated that they can't get access to those gifts. So thinking outside the box, multitasking, being exploratory rather than inhibitory, these are positive signs. The genes that promote ADHD wouldn't have survived in the gene pool unless they had some adaptive significance throughout past cultures. It's a matter of severity, and it's a matter of fit. If, as some high-level chief executives have admitted, they've got ADHD, a lot of them have many personal assistants and have other people to do some of the dirty work that they can't do so well. Other people need training in self-regulation so that those highly creative gifts can be channeled and you don't crash and burn. So I think there's an element of truth here, but all too often, and as severity goes up, the problems related to ADHD make it really difficult to show those gifts and put them to their full effect.
I have another listener, Richard Scheffler, who for some reason thinks that both you and Stephen Hinshaw are pediatricians. Just disabuse him of that. But who says pediatricians ought not to make the diagnosis of ADHD. It ought to be an educational school psychologist who've spent years in graduate school and practice studying and giving in detailed research tests designed to diagnose ADHD and other learning disabilities.
Well, I want to thank the reader. I've spent so much time and learned so much from Steve Hinshaw that your reader or your caller thinks I'm a pediatrician. Steve is not a pediatrician either, but he's probably, in this particular case, better qualified than I to answer that question. So I'm going to pass it back to Steve.
He's questioning, Steve Hinshaw, the role pediatricians play as opposed to psychologists like yourself or...
I really believe that the answer, and a key part of the answer, lies in multidisciplinary teams. We need the medical side. Medical doctors prescribe medications. Neurologists can do tests for seizure disorders that might be appropriate. Psychologists, both clinical and school psychologists, are more familiar with the kinds of behavioral interventions and the kinds of rating checklists and observational methods needed for appropriate assessment. I don't know of any master clinician who can do everything on his or her own. If we could get college students as observers in classrooms, if we could get teachers, doctors, psychologists, educational administrators participating in teams to really evaluate the curriculum of the school.
And parents.
The needs of the kids. Parents, too, of course, without the parent data, we're doomed to make an appraisal of when is this normal boyhood or girlhood? When is this in the 99.9th percentile? And no matter what easy accommodations you could make, this kid would still be struggling. We need a team approach. That would take away a lot of the onus on the individual clinician, too often a pediatrician, only having 10 minutes reimbursed in his or her practice and forced to make a quick yes or no decision. That's not a good state of affairs.
We bring another caller on. Phil, that's you. Welcome to Forum.
Thanks, Michael. And first, thanks for having Dr. Hinshaw and his colleague on. You know, there's so many people writing so many crazy things about ADHD out there that are misleading. It's great to have a real expert who's been doing this for a long time. I'm a child psychologist. I work a lot with diagnosing ADHD, and I'm actually happy to say that at Kaiser we do exactly what he just described. We have a team-based integrative approach where pediatricians refer, the kids get an observation in a simulated classroom. We do a developmental history interview. We send a bunch of forms home. Sometimes we do a continuous performance task. And only then might we refer back to the pediatrician or the psychiatrist for medication. I want to ask Dr. Hinshaw about behavioral approaches. I know he's studying some in his lab, but I first want to just clear up something you said, Michael, which is that Adderall is a gateway drug. You know, for these performance-enhancing, often young adults or high school kids, that's probably really true. But for younger kids who actually have ADHD, it's the opposite of a gateway drug. There is a much higher risk of substance abuse in untreated ADHD than the general population. I think parents really need to understand that by treating their kids, they're not turning them into drug addicts. They're in many cases preventing addiction because they're giving the kid a chance to feel successful and not have the most common misdiagnosis in some sectors, which is bad kids, as opposed to ADHD. So the question, though, is about behavioral intervention. Is traditionally we've seen this as something delivered through parents is behavior modification, teaching parents to structure the environment, particularly of young kids, in a way that helps them regulate themselves, stay on task, have those clear limits. But I know, Dr. Hinshaw, in your lab, you're looking at direct training with kids and skills building, and I haven't seen a lot of evidence come out yet for that, and I know you guys are going to publish something soon. Do you have any preliminary findings on what is actually helpful in that approach?
So this is the holy grail. If we could do more than just have a more structured home environment, a better regulated classroom environment with small steps and regular graded rewards, if we could get that inside the kids or teens or adults' head so they could self-regulate, that's what we're all about. The problem is that up until today in recorded history, no one-on-one treatments have ever been able to bridge this gap of, if you change the environment, are you changing the mind and brain to get these gains to generalize? There's some promising leads. For adults with ADHD, cognitive behavioral therapy, looking at your life, taking specific steps, trying out different ways, more than for kids with ADHD, might be the first step towards self-regulation. People are interested in training better working memory, doing neurofeedback to change the brain waves. None of those has, as of yet, provided the lasting benefits that we're all after. Right now, ADHD is a relatively low-tech diagnosis with all this multidisciplinary team effort. And It's a treatment that requires parents and teachers and the individual himself or herself and for adults' relationship partners working together to try to help gradually forge better self-regulation.
Phil, we thank you for the call.
Michael, can I add one thing?
Yeah, please.
I would just say, because I've been doing this as a, just to try to help, anyone who's ever tried to teach mindfulness skills to a hyperactive seven-year-old will know why this is not yet empirically friendly.
Yeah, good luck on that.
Medicine,
yeah.
Sometimes it's helpful, but it's very, very hard. So thanks so much for your expertise, and we look forward to more results from your lab.
Yeah, well, thank you for that call. How much or how common is late onset, that is adult onset of ADHD?
So there's a lot of interest, of course, in adult ADHD these days. And the first question the clinician ought to be asking is, did this start yesterday? If you wake up at age 35 suddenly with ADHD without a day of it formally in your life, my question would be, so what drugs have you started taking, or where did you get your head injury?
Or what were the triggers, period.
Right. So the first question is, let's talk about the pattern from childhood through adolescence and your adulthood. Maybe it wasn't diagnosed back then. Maybe people didn't know enough. Maybe there was stigma. But there should be a developmental pattern that maybe it's a pretty bright individual, a lot of supports at home and school, and now for the first time there's a job that requires intense self-regulation. That may be why the ADHD symptoms are suddenly salient in adulthood, but it doesn't appear de novo at age 30, 40, or 50 unless there's been some striking cause.
Well, if there's more success with intervention, Richard Scheffler, what does that do potentially for, I'm thinking about adults again, but for the kind of disability payments for those who have ADHD who can't work because of it?
Well, I think if you are disabled, there are payments you can get. For this, Social Security payments for children and also this estate disability. But the disability has to be pretty serious. You have to show that the ADHD that you have is serious enough that you cannot work and hold a job. This is, you know, extremely important, and these disabilities are serious like any other disability, and we need to understand that, and I think these payments are absolutely appropriate. But we also hope that people with this disability will seek out treatment and be able to return to the labor market and be productive citizens. And often this can happen with the right medication and behavioral therapy, as Steve has pointed out. A lot of it is scheduling, executive functions, and self-regulation, and these things can be taught to people of any age.
Again, we're talking to co-authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. And we'll bring on another caller. Cindy, that's you. Hi.
Hi there. So thank you so much. It has been wonderful listening to these guys. The reason that I'm calling in is to suggest another strong link between ADHD and sleep disorders. Last year, there was an article that showed that sleep disorders were actually one cause of ADHD. And as far back as 1997, there was data that suggested that sleep disorders could be causing or contributing to up to about a quarter of ADHD cases. But sleep disorders are very underdiagnosed, especially in children. And so that's what I wanted to bring up.
I'm glad you brought it up, Cindy. And I'm looking at a tweet here from a listener who wants to know how you feel about Dr. Daniel Ammon's studies, which shows that ADD can be helped by not only proper sleep, but diet and exercise. Stephen Hinshaw?
So let's talk about sleep first. It's a huge chicken and egg question. If you're, quote, amped up and you're hyper and you're impulsive, maybe you're having trouble regulating even when you're trying to sleep. Or maybe if you have a fundamental sleep disturbance, as we all know, when we are sleep deprived, it's hard to pay attention and focus and drive well and all those things. And so we've got A causing B, B causing A. Maybe there's underlying factors C, D, and E that cause both the sleep and the ADHD problem. There's finally a lot of good research being done on this at this point.
Thank
what
you.
About diet and exercise?
Yeah,
if
what
I could
about
do it quickly.
Diet and exercise?
diet's important, but it is not the major cause of ADHD. Every kid needs good exercise, but lack of exercise doesn't cause ADHD. We have to look holistically at what's best for each individual, but the evidence-based treatments of medication when it's needed, if it's well followed, and the skill-building behavioral and cognitive behavioral treatments, that's where the money is.
And here's a listener who writes, many of my family have ADHD and other learning disabilities. I was reading that having preschoolers play memory games can help with memories. The games also include a delayed gratification. Can this help?
So there's a lot of interest in what's called direct cognitive training. Maybe you can increase working memory. How many digits can you remember forwards and backwards? And we know that kids in general and kids with ADHD can gradually improve that form of working memory. The problem is that for kids with ADHD, that simple working memory improvement doesn't automatically at all translate into better homework or classroom performance. It's too simple to think that just by boosting these cognitive skills, we've magically cured the ADHD. If it were that simple, I'd be happy, but it's not that simple.
Well, we think too often. I mean, Richard Scheffler, as a health economist and public policy expert, I think this comes down to the fact that we're looking too often for magic bullets or quick ways. That's a big part of this problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we're a society that likes magic bullets and likes medications that solve things. And unfortunately, for ADHD, there is no magic bullet. It's a very complicated diagnosis. There's a range of symptoms in ADHD, from attention to hyperactivity. There's different forms of it. There's lots of comorbidities. Children who have ADHD are highly likely to have something else like anxiety disorder or sometimes even depression and the like. So this is complicated. There is no magic bullet. There is no exact answer to it. So unfortunately, we don't have the answer, and we're not likely to have the answer, I think, in the foreseeable future of one magic bullet.
However, there is a lot of useful information in your book, and thank you so much for being with us and sharing some of that. Richard Scheffler and Stephen Hinshaw are co-authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Path for Performance. Richard Scheffler is professor of health economics and public policy at UC Berkeley. Stephen Hinshaw, professor of psychology there and vice chair for psychology at UCSF. Thank you for being a part of today's program and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.